BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi, I'm Lauren Laverne. Welcome to an extra special edition of the Desert Island Discs podcast, where guests are invited to choose the 8 tracks, book and luxury item that they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. There are over 2,000 archive episodes on BBC Sounds. That's a lot. And whether you're a regular listener or new to the programme, you might not know where to start. Well, the good news is I'm here to help. I'm going to share with you some of my favourite editions from our incredible back catalogue. I hope they'll bring you as much joy as they bring me. I'll be bringing you a world-renowned pianist, an award-winning African-American writer and poet, a best-selling crime author, a star judge from Strictly, and one of the most inspiring personal stories you will ever hear anywhere. And of course, some fantastic music. So let's start with a dancer. Len Goodman, former head judge of Strictly, was born in London's East End and he sold veg from his grandfather's stall and became a welder in the docks. But every Saturday, he'd don his glad rags and go off dancing. Kirsty cast him away in 2011 and she asked him about growing up in London's Bethnal Green.
Well, it was Bethnal Green. We actually moved when I was quite young out into Kent.
Right.
When I was 4 or 5. However, my mum used to take me all the time back up to Bethnal Green and I used to play with all the kids in my street and so on. So my early memories are of being around Bethnal Green in our little house there, my grandparents' house. Saturday nights, my nan and one of my uncles were great on the piano, just self-taught and having a sing-song. And my mum used to teach me a little song. You can roll a silver dollar down upon the ground. And I'd be sitting there on the by the fireplace giving my little bit. It was just wonderful memories.
And you did you like a bit of an audience? Were you a bit of a show-off?
Always. I was quite gregarious and outgoing and...
Your grandfather's business then was a fruit and veg business.
Yes, right. And then once I became about 11, he'd got a shop. Before that, he had a stall. And on a Saturday and during my school holidays, I'd be in charge of the salad stall. And that would be my job. And I think that helped me as well to get to chat with people and not to be shy and outgoing.
And what about, was your grandfather a bit of a, I mean, the image we have, maybe a cliched one of people who run those businesses, certainly back in the day, is that, you know, bit of a Del boy, bit of a mover and shaker.
Do you know, I remember one of the earliest memories I have of him, in his shop, he used to have two, they call them bins, where they used to put the groceries and stuff. And he had a big 100-weight sack of potatoes and he chucked one half into this one bin and the other half into the other bin. Mm-hmm. And on one, he put a penny a pound. And on the other, it said, selected, penny halfpenny. And I said, but Grandad, they're the same potato. He said, yeah, but you watch, the penny halfpenny ones will always go first. And that's, you know, so they were like that.
A lesson in life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what about the beetroot boiler? Did you have a bath in the beetroot boiler?
Yeah. Nan's job was to get the raw beetroots and they had this like cauldron that had like 6 gas ring things that went underneath and they used to boil that up and then the beetroots would go in. Well, when it was tepid, my nan used to put me in it and scrub me up. And, of course, I was always filthy dirty. We used to go and play on the debris from the war. And, of course, out I'd come and it would be covered in scum and then in would go the beetroot.
Is that true?
Yeah, truly. And everybody used to say how delicious they were. I think it was
That special stock.
Yeah.
That special little Len stock.
Yeah, that's delicious. Right. And quite often I'd have a pee in it as well, of course, as you do. And
I wasn't going to ask that,
well,
but
no,
I'm glad
but
you mentioned it. Let's have some music, Len Goodman. What's next?
Well, one of my earliest memories is my dad taking me into the front room where he had a most marvellous record player, Grundig. One side there was a cocktail cabinet.
Oh.
It was very posh.
Posh.
And the other side was the record player. And he used to play all his favourites from the war and before the war. And he used to love the Mills Brothers. Their only backing is a guitar and everything else you hear is just them making the noise with their mouths. And it's just happy, happy music. And I think if I'm stuck on a desert island, I'm going to get glum and I want to be cheered up. And I think this is the sort of music that just cheers you up.
Hold that tiger, 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 hold that tiger. Where's that tiger? Where's that tiger?
Where's that tiger? Is that tiger? Where's that tiger? Is that tiger?
That was the Mills Brothers and Tiger Rag. So you were an only child, Len Goodman?
Yes, I was.
Doted
luckily.
Upon, yes? Spoiled?
Doted, totally doted upon. Spoilt rotten.
Were you?
Oh, yeah! Lovely! Wonderful!
Isn't it true? Did your mum buy you a very fancy car when you were
when
a teenager?
When I was 17.
Yes.
You know, we'd made it by then. We had 7 greengrocer's shops and this and that and plenty of money coming in. When I was 17, my mum was worried that I'd learn to drive and have a crash. So she said, I'm not having that. You're going to have a nice, sturdy vehicle. So for my 17th birthday, brand new Jaguar.
Oh.
Yeah, Mark II. Thing like Morse drives, you
beautiful,
know, proper
yeah.
thing. And then I had a little accident, not a big one, in a car park. A car backed into me and just knocked it slightly. And I got home, I said, Mum, look, a car backed. She said, you're not driving that. It might have knocked the wheels out of line or something. Bought me another one. Yeah, look at me. See?
So
spoiled like you can't believe. But I've turned out absolutely fantastic.
Clearly. Before you were 17, your parents had divorced when you were how old?
When I was about 10, my parents divorced. They split up, but in not in a horrible way. They split up and I still saw my dad and I lived with my mum. And it was fine.
Nonetheless, quite unusual, and that would have been the early 50s, was it?
When yeah. The, yeah. Oh, it was a big shock horror.
Yeah.
It was, oh, yeah. It was, yeah, middle 50s, I guess, something
right.
like that. But, you know, I'll tell you a little anecdote regarding all this. My dad found my stepmother, who's still alive, 95 now, hopefully listening in. But my mum was on her own, and I went to a Danson Park swimming pool and cut my leg quite badly on a stone step. I went to the first aid man. So he went on the tannoy in this open-air pool and said anyone leaving could take a little boy to the hospital. Well, a man came along and said, I'm just leaving, I'll take him. And he took me to the hospital. And he said, where do you live, son? And I told him. He said, I'll run you home. So he took me back to my house. And by then it was swelling up and throbbing and I was crying a bit. So he picked me up and carried me to the front door of my house, knocked on the door. My mum said, hello, he said, your son's injured himself. So she said, come in. And 6 months later, she married him.
Really?
There, that's how they met.
How extraordinary.
It's a good story, though, isn't it? And it is true.
It is a great story, Len. The legend that is Len Goodman, speaking to Kirsty Young in 2011. Up next, Maya Angelou, the American writer and poet. Although everything that she did was poetic, as you will hear. She was brought up by her grandmother in Arkansas in the south of America during the Depression and was interviewed for Desert Island Discs by Michael Parkinson in 1988. Here she is.
I remember my grandmother owned a store. It was the only black-owned store in the town. And so we had goods on the shelves. Mama, however, was a typical West African market woman. I never knew that until I moved to West Africa. But she sold things. So the people had no money, but the poorer people would go down and get the handouts, powdered eggs, powdered milk, lard, margarine, which was white, just like lard, but with yellow stuff you could mix with it, make it butter-colored. And they would bring that stuff back to the store and swap with my grandmother. She would give them tins, so many tins of mackerel, in exchange for so many buckets of powdered eggs. Well, it turned out my brother and I were the only kids in the school who were eating powdered eggs. Everybody else, if we wanted peanut butter, we'd have to go around to somebody's back door because Mama would have traded our peanut butter for some powdered milk, which was horrible.
Was it very rigidly segregated?
Absolutely.
When did you first come across directly racial prejudice?
Well, I guess I was about 8. We went to the movies, my brother and I, and there was a girl, a white girl, behind the in the box office who would take the dimes of all the white kids, take them by hand. But when my brother put our dimes up, she had a cigar box and she would tell him, rake them into the cigar box. Now, mind you, she was from a family so poor they lived on my grandmother's land. And I couldn't believe this meanness. And then all the white kids would go right in through the front door, and the black kids would have to go up a very rickety outside staircase. It was very dangerous, I thought. I mean, it was so shaky. And then sort of almost crawl into a roof, which hadn't been swept, I guess, since the place had been built. So there were peanut shells and paper and all that stuff on the floor. It was pitched so. I mean, it was at such a rake, at such an angle, this balcony, which they called the buzzard's roost. It was pitched so that you had the feeling you might topple down on top of all those white folks. You know, it's just terrible. And I cried. I couldn't believe that I was such a nice girl, you know. By that time, I'd stopped talking, too, so I was really nice. I didn't lie because I couldn't speak, you know. And there I was being forced to live like that.
Well, let's talk about the reason why you became mute in a moment. Let's now have another choice of record, please, Maya.
Well, I would choose Roberta Flack's Killing Me Softly.
Singing clear and strong, strumming my bed with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song, telling my whole life with his words, killing me softly with his song.
Roberta Flack and Killing Me Softly. Maya Angelou, you mentioned there just before we played that record that at the age of about 8 you were mute. What were the circumstances of that?
Pretty dreadful. When I was 7 and a half, I was raped by my mother's boyfriend. And the rapist was killed. The policeman told my grandmother, my mother's mother, with whom I was staying, that the man had been kicked to death, they thought. And I heard that. And somehow, with my 7 and a half year old logic, I decided that my voice had killed him. That because I told who did it, that my voice was the culprit. And so I decided that I'd better not talk, because anybody whose name I called or who heard me might die. So I stopped.
And how long did that last?
About 5 years.
And what rescued you from that silence?
Poetry.
Right?
Yeah. I loved poetry. And a woman in my town, a black lady, started me at about 8 to reading the books in the library. I kept a tablet, and I would write on the tablet whenever anybody asked me anything. And in the schools, because Mama, my grandmother, owned most of the land, and lots of the land rather than that, people sort of couldn't be too unkind, you know, because I was her California grandbaby. Although out of her hearing, they would say things to me about me like this. Mm-mm, it's a shame Sister Henderson's California granddaughter done gone mental. And that, they're brutes. But finally, Mrs. Flowers, this lovely lady, had me over to her house. I was about almost 12. And she would ask me about things I'd read and what did I like, and I'd write. And she said, you think you like poetry, you don't like poetry. Well, I couldn't believe that. She knew I loved it. She said, no, you don't like poetry. I was writing furiously, I love it. She said, you'll never like it until you speak it, until you feel it come across your tongue, through your teeth, over your lips. You will never love poetry. I ran out of her house. I ran to the store. She came to the store. And she pointed her finger at me which is a very serious thing, Michael, for black Americans. We have a saying that goes from Jesse Jackson to the wino on the street corner. Don't put your finger in my face. That is very serious. She pointed her finger at me, which is, I mean, she knew better. But just to really shock me, she said, you don't like poetry. She continued harassing me for months until finally I went under the house and I tried to speak poetry. And I had a voice. And so Mrs. Flowers and Poetry returned my voice to me.
And what a voice it was. Can't get enough of it. A stunning listen recorded back in 1988 when Sir Michael Parkinson was presenting the programme. Next, we have another very talented artist for you, though in a completely different discipline and with a very different story. The pianist Lang Lang was a child prodigy and classical music phenomenon, and his talent and showmanship have earned him worldwide renown. He's played for presidents, royalty, and a global audience of 4.5 billion at the opening of the 2008 Beijing Olympics. But when he was interviewed by Kirsty Young in 2010, he very movingly talked about the cost of all that and the price that he had to pay for his success, and gave an insight into the dedication that his father would demand from his only child.
Chopin's waltz in D-flat major, known, of course, as the Minute Waltz, played there by Arthur Rubinstein. You were saying, Lang Lang, that that memorably was your first recital. That was one of the pieces that you played. And you said that you and your father talked about this idea of being the number one pianist in China. It was an intense relationship from the beginning, was it?
In the very beginning, it was okay, actually. The relationship became pretty tough when my mom stayed at home and my father quit his job to be with me in Beijing to prepare to take audition to the best conservatory in China. At that time, it became very intensive.
Your parents were artistic people themselves, mm-hmm. your father being the leader of the local orchestra. Mm-hmm. What about your mother?
My mom actually loves music. When she was very young, yeah, she wanted to be a musician, but of course, I mean, in the end, she turns to have a decent job, but it's nothing exciting and nothing musical.
Did you get a sense that in a way you were sort of expressing their artistic passions, that these were two people who very much had to more than knuckle down? You know, they absolutely had their paths worked out for them by the community and the time that they lived in, but you could express yourself musically and artistically.
Yeah, I mean, my parents had a huge dream, but that generation of people, I think many of them just achieved their dream in a halfway, you know, because the revolution really, you know, that's disturbed.
And yes.
After the reforms time, which is after 79, we are actually only allowed to have one kid, so yeah. Only child generation. So therefore, I mean, I felt in my generation that the parents put a lot of pressure on the kid, because first of all, many of them didn't achieve their dream. And then now they have chance, but only one chance. One kid only. So you can imagine it's a very unusual time. But in the other hand, if I have let's say 4 siblings like my mom, or like 5 siblings like my father, then I don't think I will have the chance to study piano, because that's involved with a lot of money and efforts and education and focus. So in a way it worked for me.
I want to ask you a little bit more later about mm-hmm. your journey to Beijing and leaving mm-hmm. your mother. That happened mm-hmm. when you were around about nine.
Nine, yeah.
There's something now in China, I understand, called the Lang Lang effect, which is that there are estimated to be more than 35 million young Chinese piano players. How are you treated by those young piano players when you go home? Are you able to walk down the streets?
I mean, seriously, piano become some real phenomenon in mm. China. I don't know whether it's to do with me or not, but piano became the number one instrument. Of course, I can walk to the street without security, but I mean, I got a lot of picture taken.
Right.
But that's actually nice. When I go out for a coffee or something, people stop and then take a picture or asking for autograph. And sometimes I got mobbed, but it's all feel good, because if classical musicians can also be loved by the general public, it's a great thing.
Okay, let's have some more music then. We're on disc number 3 now. What are we going to hear?
Now we're going to listen to my favorite singer, Luciano Pavarotti, and his most famous song, Sola Mia. This one really inspired me to start listening to classical operas. And Pavarotti is the first classical tenor to reach out to millions of people.
Che bella cosa, una giornata e sole, un'aria serena dopo una tempesta, e un'aria fresca pare già una festa. Che bella cosa, una giornata e sole.
Luciano Pavarotti and O Sole Mio, my son. So, Lang Lang, you say you were 9 then when you moved from the family home in Shenyang, that's just northeast of Beijing,
yes,
to Beijing itself. You moved with your father, and the purpose there was to get you into the conservatory.
Yes. I remember the first day I got so depressed because we moved into a real small and very poor and dirty neighborhood. I think 6 families share one toilet.
Is it true that your father would get up at 5 in the morning and go to this communal toilet area and lock himself in order that when you woke a couple of hours later, you didn't have to queue to use the bathroom? Is that a true story?
Yeah, not every morning, but sometimes, yes, it is. Most neighbors understood, but some neighbors hate it. You know,
this was to do then about the management of your time, that you could not spend an hour queuing because that was time that you could be practicing, was that
right,
it?
Right, right,
yeah. I mean, there are things that I've read that sometimes seem difficult to believe. Did he also, when you were practicing, because the flat that you lived in was so cold, is it true that he got into bed to warm your bed? And
Yes, that's true, yeah.
What do you make of that?
I think that's father's love. I think that's really shows his love for me and his support, you know, as a father. I got very emotional when I remember those things.
Yeah.
But in the same time, my father was very tough, you know, so it was like real love and hate relationship.
The remarkable Lang Lang in conversation with Kirsty in 2010. Now to Scotland and Val McDermott, a fantastic writer. I just loved her programme. It was such a vivid depiction of a young woman finding her voice and finding a path in a world that didn't necessarily seem like it was going to provide one for her. As a crime fiction writer, her stories certainly don't spare the reader. Domestic violence, murder, abduction, it all features. She was the first state school educated Scot to win a place at St Hilda's College in Oxford when she was just 16. And when Kirsty Young cast her away in 2013, she talked about her childhood growing up in Kirkcaldy, Fife.
Val McDermott, you were a clever girl, and at one point your family moved opposite the library, and I understand that you were in and out of that place on a daily basis. What were you reading? Crime fiction?
Anything. No, there was no crime fiction, unless you count Enid Blyton, really, and the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. I just worked my way around the fiction shelves. And although you could take 4 books out at a time, 2 of them had to be non-fiction. As heaven forfend, you should just have unmitigated pleasure. So I was reading really anything I could get my hands on, and the library did become my second home.
Growing up in Fife, you've said that you felt different from other people. Can you articulate that feeling?
I felt like an outsider. I didn't feel that my concerns were the same as the concerns of my contemporaries. I grew up in Kirkcaldy, and I went to a school that was very strongly academic. But Fife was in many ways quite a parochial, quite a closed world. And generally speaking, in Fife, if you were bright, you went to Edinburgh or St Andrews University. And if you weren't quite so bright, you went to Dundee or Stirling. And then you came back to Fife. Probably 85, 90% of the people who taught me were from Fife. And I wanted something beyond those horizons. But I just assumed that was because the one thing I really wanted was to be a writer. Because in the 1960s in Fife, there were no lesbians. They didn't exist. It wasn't even a word that crossed people's horizon, really. So I had no way of realising what my sexuality was and what that meant for me.
Did you spend a lot of time alone?
Yes. I had a big Labrador retriever, and the two of us used to often just go off for the day by ourselves, me and the dog and a book.
Now, here's something from your younger years that might help us figure out a bit more about you. You'd been to England just once. You went on a week's holiday to Blackpool, and you decided that you were going to go to Oxford University based on that. Yeah. 1 week in Blackpool.
Yes.
That's
obviously.
That's quite a leap at the age of... Well, you went for the interview at 16.
Yeah.
You were offered a place. You attended Oxford University from the age of 17. How did you find it?
It was a complete culture shock. It was unlike anything I'd ever experienced. I mean, I ended up going there because of the books I'd read from the library, you know, because I read the Shelley School books. And when people left the Shelley School books, they either went to the Sorbonne or Oxford or the Kensington School of Needlework. And I knew I wasn't going to the Kensington School of Needlework. And my French wasn't good enough for the Sorbonne, so that only left Oxford. Everything was different. Even the vegetables were different. The accent was different. Nobody understood a word I said. You know, I come from Fife Ken, where folk talk like that. Where the spugs fly back was to keep the stew out the rain.
Aye.
And nobody understood what I was saying, Ken.
Tell me about the vegetables.
Well, things I'd never seen before. I mean, mushrooms came out of a tin. I'd never seen a mushroom as a mushroom. I'd never seen red peppers or green peppers.
Oh,
I'd
yes.
never seen watercress or celery. First time we went to an Italian restaurant, I looked at this and pasta, what the hell's this? I knew what a pizza was, though. So I ordered a pizza. And this round flat thing came and I'm like, that's not a pizza. And everybody's looking at me like I'm completely mad. I'm going, it's not a pizza. Pizza's half moon shaped and covered in batter. And everybody's like, she is just seriously from another planet.
There will be a few people listening who actually know what we're talking about.
Yeah. Deep fried pizza.
Delicious. Let's have some music then, Val McDermott. We're on your fourth choice.
This is the Allegro from the Brandenburg No. 6, and it's a wonderful piece of music. But this was one of my first experiences of classical music. And when I went to Oxford, one of the things that people tended to do was after dinner and evening, you'd go back to somebody's room and they'd put on some music generally. And this was one of the first pieces of classical music that I heard that actually something went ping inside my head, and I thought, that is amazing. There was something about the way that the music was constructed that really seemed to feed into my brain in a way that made everything sort of sharper and brighter. And this also, I have to say, I associate with my first love, because my final year at Oxford, I finally actually managed to fall in love with someone who fell in love with me. And when I hear this music, sometimes I can still picture a sort of an autumn afternoon with the sun fading from the sky, sitting by a gas fire, toasting crumpets and. So it takes me back in a good way as well to those years.
Part of the Allegro from Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 6, played by the English Baroque soloists, conducted by John Elliott Gardner, chosen by crime writer Val McDermott, whose cultural métier includes both Bach and deep-fried pizza, my kind of woman. At Christmas 1992, Sue Lawley's special guest was Professor Stephen Hawking. The world-renowned scientist was told at the age of 21 that he had motor neurone disease. His best-selling book, A Brief History of Time, From Big Bang to Black Holes, had been published in 1989. And 10 years later, when he recorded his Desert Island discs, he was almost completely paralysed and was using a voice synthesizer to speak. Sue asked him about going up to Oxford to study maths and physics, where he admitted to working for only an hour a day. Why couldn't he be bothered to work, she wondered.
It was the end of the 50s, and most young people were disillusioned with what was called the establishment. There seemed nothing to look forward to but affluence and more affluence. The conservatives had just won their third election victory with the slogan, "You've never had it so good." I, and most of my contemporaries at Oxford, were bored with life. There didn't seem anything worth working for.
Nevertheless, you still managed to solve in a few hours problems that your fellow students couldn't do in as many weeks. They were obviously aware, from what they've said since, that you had an exceptional talent. Were you aware, do you think?
The physics course at Oxford at that time was ridiculously easy. One could get through without going to any lectures, but just by going to one or two tutorials a week. You didn't need to remember many facts, just a few equations.
But it was at Oxford, wasn't it, that you first noticed that your hands and feet weren't quite doing what you wanted them to do. How did you explain that to yourself at the time?
In fact, the first thing I noticed was that I couldn't row a sculling boat properly. Then I had a bad fall down the stairs from the college junior common room. I went to the college doctor after the fall because I was worried that I might have brain damage. However, he thought there was nothing wrong and told me to cut down on the beer. After my finals at Oxford, I went to Persia for the summer. I was definitely weaker when I came back, but I thought that was caused by a bad stomach upset that I had had.
But at what point did you give in and admit that there was something really wrong and decide to get medical advice?
I went home for Christmas. That was the very cold winter of 62 to 63. My mother persuaded me to go and skate on the lake in St. Albans, even though I knew I was not really up to it. I fell over and had great difficulty getting up. My mother realized there was something wrong. She took me to the family doctor.
And then 3 weeks in hospital, and they told you the worst.
I was in for 2 weeks, having tests, but they never actually told me what was wrong, except that it was not MS, and that it was not a typical case. They didn't tell me what the prospects were, but I guessed enough to know that they were pretty bad, so I didn't want to ask.
And finally, in fact, you were told that you only had a couple of years or so to live. Let's pause at that point in your story and have your next record, Stephen.
The Vaguery, Act 1. After I was diagnosed with motor neurone disease in 1963, I turned to Werner as someone who suited the dark and apocalyptic mood I was in. Unfortunately, my speech synthesizer is not very well educated and pronounces him Wagner. I had to spell him V-A-R-G-N-E-R to get it to sound approximately right. The four operas of the Ring Cycle are Werner's greatest work. I went to see them at Barrett in Germany with my sister, Philippa, in 1964. I didn't know the Ring well at that time, and the Vaguery, the second opera in the cycle, made a tremendous impression on me.
Schläfst du, Gast?
Ja, schleich daher.
Ich bin, höre mich an. In tiefem Schlaf liegt um dich. Ich würz im betäubenden Trank. Nütze die Nacht dir zum Reuen.
Nein, mach mich dein an.
Eine Waffe lass mich dir weisen. Um ihn zu siegen. Saß hier im Saal, von Hunding zur Hochzeit geladen.
erfreut ein Weib, das ungefragt Schächer ihm schenkten zur Frau.
Lotte Lehmann and Laurits Melchior singing part of Act One of Wagner's Die Walküre with the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Bruno Walter. Reading about you, Stephen, it almost seems as if that death sentence, being told you had only a couple of years or so to live, woke you up, if you like, made you concentrate on life.
Its first effect was to depress me. I seemed to be getting worse fairly rapidly. There didn't seem any point in doing anything, or working on my PhD, because I didn't know I would live long enough to finish it. But then things started to improve. The condition developed more slowly, and I began to make progress in my work, particularly in showing that the universe must have had a beginning, in a big bang.
But you've even said in one interview that you thought you were happier now than before you got ill.
I certainly am happier now. Before I got motor neuron disease, I was bored with life. But the prospect of an early death made me realize life was really worth living. There is so much one can do, so much that anyone can do. I have a real feeling of achievement, that I have made a modest, but significant, contribution to human knowledge, despite my condition. Of course, I am very fortunate, but everyone can achieve something if they try hard enough.
The late and truly inspiring Professor Stephen Hawking. Do listen to the whole of that programme. It's an absolute joy. And as with all the extracts I've brought you today, you can find it on BBC Sounds. I hope you've enjoyed this extra podcast from the Desert Island Discs back catalogue. There are so many to choose from. And if you have favourite editions that you think other people might enjoy, please do share them on social media using the hashtag Desert Island Discs. That's all from me for now. I'll be back with a new edition of the programme on Sunday at 11:15. I hope you'll join me then.